Chapter 26. I rode along slowly back to Chancery Lane, the boy trotting along at my side, one hand on Genesis's harness to avoid being separated from me in the crowded streets. I reflected that Harsnett wouldn't be pleased at my news, certain as he was that Goddard was the killer. As of course he still might be, but we must find the identity of this man who had visited the prostitute. It was still early, the shopkeepers again opening up and throwing out any beggars they found in their doorways. One, a young man had collapsed in the street and was being half-carried by two others. Timothy looked at the scene, then up at me, his face frightened. On impulse, I halted and told him to climb up behind me. We reached my house and I could see from his wide-eyed expression that Timothy was overawed by its size. I led him inside and through to the kitchen where Joan was working. I was pleased to see that Harsnett's man Orr was helping her peeling potatoes. Joan exclaimed at the boy's dirtiness, gave him a bucket of water, and ordered him to the stable to wash himself down. He went out obediently. Young Peter was in the kitchen and greeted Timothy with a surly nod. Joan frowned at him. "You'd better treat Timothy well. He's younger than you and in a new place. You should be pleased he'll be doing some of the jobs you don't like. Now, take him those old clothes of yours I looked out to cut up because they'd got too small." "Yes, Mistress Joan." Peter sidled out of the room. Joan smiled at me. I smiled back. Degree matters for everyone, does it not? Even kitchen boys. "It's as much the fear of losing a place. So many beggar boys in London now, you can always find one cheaper than the one you have." "Yes. Such competition brings fear." When this was over, I decided, I would hire a man too to help Joan. I could easily afford it. I went upstairs to change into my best robe. Although the day was the warmest so far, I felt cold, and the stitches in my arm ached as I dressed. I ran over the arguments I'd prepared for Adam's case, for the court to receive regular reports on his care and for his fees to be met out of the Bedlam funds. I'd arranged for Guy to be present to testify that Adam was so ill he needed the court's protection. As for his release, I felt there was no question now but that he was safest where he was. Would he ever be cured, I wondered, or would he stay forever imprisoned in that terrible agony of soul? And what of the killer we were hunting? Did he suffer? My sense was that he enjoyed what he did, the meticulous planning and the cruel execution. Already, somewhere out there, he was planning his next killing. I had the part of the Book of Revelation that dealt with the seven angels off by heart now. "And the fifth angel poured out his vial upon the seat of the beast, and his kingdom waxed dark, and they gnawed their tongues for pain." The seat of the beast, I knew, was supposed to be the lair of the devil. They gnawed their tongues for pain. I shivered. Barrack was waiting for me in the crowded vestibule of the Court of Requests. I looked around the familiar scene. The parties sitting round the walls watching the lawyers negotiating in the centre of the room. I recognised an elderly couple sitting with my fellow pleader in requests, Brother Irvin. Irvin gave me a curt nod. I had greatly added to his workload by standing out most of my cases. I would lose money by this, I suppose, though that was the least of my worries. I had enough. The old couple who were pursuing a claim against their landlord and had come all the way from Lancashire to find justice gave me hurt looks. Daniel and Minnie Kite stood huddled together in the doorway with Guy, dressed in his physician's robe and cap. Barrack and I joined them.
"Adam's not here, sir," Daniel said anxiously.
"We're a little early. They'll bring him."
Will they be gentle with him? Minnie asked anxiously.
This judge is a fair man. Is Reverend Meepher not with you today?
He's been detained at a neighbouring parish. The minister there's sick.
I was interrupted by a hard tap on my injured arm, which made me wince. I turned to find myself looking at a short, spare man in his 40s, dressed in an expensive fur-lined coat, a silk velvet cap on his head. His thin face had the red puffiness and broken veins of a hard drinker.
"Are you here for that kite, boy?"
he asked in a peremptory tone. I bowed. "I am, sir."
"I'm Sir George Metwys, Warden of the Bedlam. I am here at the request of Archbishop Cranmer."
He glared at the kites and at Guy.
"I don't know why the Archbishop has interested himself in these people."
"I am grateful for your attendance, sir," I said smoothly. "Perhaps you could indicate whether you will be opposing my applications for Master Kite's welfare to be reported regularly to the court and his fees to be paid from the Bedlam funds?"
"Paid by you from the profits you take from the paying inmates," I thought. "You'll have a little less to get drunk on."
"I won't be opposing," Metwys grunted. "I've had a hint from Cranmer's people. Though if I had my way..."
He broke off as a rattling sound and then a groan echoed round the crowded chamber. Everyone turned round. Keeper Shorms, assisted by two stout underkeepers, were dragging Adam into the vestibule. His legs were chained together, and the keepers held him up by his stick-like arms. He was trying to sink to the floor to pray, groaning when they wouldn't let him. Shorms looked red with embarrassment. Daniel Kite bit his lip and his wife let out a sob. Adam, his head bowed, didn't even look at us as he passed. He gave off a foul odour. I watched as the keeper's man handled Adam onto a bench and sat beside him. On either side, people shuffled away, one man crossing himself. Somehow, the spectacle of Adam's condition seemed more terrible in this familiar environment than it had in the Bedlam, or even when he was shrieking on top of London Wall. Minnie made a move towards him. Guy laid a restraining hand on her arm.
"Not now," he whispered.
"What an exhibition," Metwys said.
He glared at Adam and his keepers. Shorms, seeing the warden, rose and bowed deeply. We waited uncomfortably for a further half hour. From where Adam sat, there was a periodic clank of chains as he tried to lurch down onto his knees. Guy went over to try to talk to him, but today he made no impression. He returned defeated. Barak had been watching the scene fixedly.
"Jeez, you,"
he murmured as Adam tried to lurch forward again.
"This is a nightmare."
At last the usher appeared and called everybody into court. I went to the advocate's bench in the front and laid out my papers. Metwys took a seat at the back, away from Adam and his keepers. Barak and Guy and the kite sat with Adam on the bench near the front. Judge Ainsworth appeared from an inner door and sat down on his bench. As he cast his eyes over the court, Adam let out a groan. Ainsworth looked at me.
"I think we'll take the case of Adam Kite first," he said. "Brother Shardlake?"
I outlined my applications. Ainsworth nodded slowly, then cast a sharp look at Shorms.
"This poor creature looks to be at death's door," he said. "Are you feeding him?"
Shorms rose, looking red and uncomfortable.
"Sometimes he won't eat, Your Honour. He has to be spoon-fed like a child, and sometimes he spits it out over the keepers."
"Then you must redouble your efforts, fellow."
He turned to Metwys.
"Sir George, you are warden. What say you to these applications?"
Metwys rose.
"I am willing to consent, Your Honour. I wish to discharge my responsibilities to the best of my abilities, but it's our rule that we only take people in the Bedlam who can be cured and for a limited time.
But surely there are many who have been there for years, their relatives paying for their keep.
I thought of the keeper, Ellen, who had said she could never leave. Metwis looked as if he might choke.
Only when their relatives cannot care for them themselves.
And are rich enough to pay to be rid of them.
Ainsworth tapped his quill on the desk.
I am minded to grant this order, though normally this would be a matter for the Court of Wards and Liveries. But I'm concerned at how long this situation may last.
He turned to Guy.
Dr. Moulton, you have been treating this boy. What do you say?
Guy stood.
Adam Kite is very sick, Your Honour. He has come to believe himself cast out of God's favour for reasons I don't fully understand. Yet, I believe that I can help him.
Then he's not some wild heretic?
No, Your Honour. Though I can see how his actions could be interpreted in that way.
He paused.
From the point of view of public order, he is best kept where he is. But I, too, wouldn't want him to be left in the bedlam indefinitely.
That would be a little unfair on Sir George Metwis' purse.
Ainsworth permitted himself a little smile, then looked again at Adam.
Is there any point in my questioning him?
Ainsworth asked me.
None, Your Honour. I doubt Master Kite is even clear where he is. Yet you think he can be helped. How long do you think you will need?
Guy hesitated.
I don't know. But I am willing to treat him without payment.
Then I will make the order. Reports to me every 14 days. Payments to be made from the Bedlam funds, subject to review by me. Review hearing in 2 months.
He looked again at Adam.
This boy is very young. Too young to be left to rot indefinitely in the bedlam because in his madness he says dangerous things.
He turned to me.
At law, if he is insane, he should be made a ward of court. Yet the Privy Council have not warded him. So, at the moment, he is in a state of legal non-existence.
That is so, Your Honour.
At the Privy Council's will. But these, I suppose, are the times we live in.
He looked at me.
Make sure he's cared for, Sergeant Shardlake.
I will, Your Honour. Ainsworth looked down at his papers and I nodded to Barrack. He nudged Shawms. The keeper's man handled Adam into the passage, and I walked out with Daniel and Minnie. Metwis followed at a distance.
Outside, Daniel and Minnie expressed their thanks. Guy offered to walk part of the way home with them.
They nodded, turning sorrowful eyes to where Adam was being hauled through the door, followed by many curious looks.
Barrack and I left them on the courthouse steps.
The rain had stopped, though the skies were still leaden.
No sign of arsenic, Barrack said.
We'll have to wait. I watched the receding figures of Guy and the kites.
Guy's tall head was bent to hear something Minnie was saying.
By God, the old Moor will need all his skills.
Barrack's voice was suddenly full of angry emotion. I turned to him.
The hearing today upset you?
Wouldn't it upset any human creature? Sometimes.
He hesitated.
What?
Sometimes these days I feel that everywhere I look there's madness and darkness and devils.
We are bound to find the killer now, as we are to aid Adam Kite. I spoke quietly, to myself as much as to him.
Aye, and here comes the man of sure and certain faith to tell us where to go next.
Barrack nodded to where Harsnett was approaching, his coat swirling round him as he shoved through the crowds around the court. He looked weary, exhausted.
The girl's escaped,
he began without preliminary.
Abigail? I asked. The prostitute? How?
asked to go to the Jakes and slipped out through the window. It's on the first floor. She's lucky she didn't break her neck.
What about Yarrington Steward?
Oh, he's safe in the Lollards Tower. Whining creature. But there's no more to be got out of him.
I have some news, at least, I said. I told him what the boy Timothy had said. Harsnett thought hard for a moment, then shook his head.
That might mean nothing. Abigail's visitor isn't necessarily the killer.
But who else would know Yarrington was keeping a whore? Unless he had a history of it.
He didn't. Harsnett shook his head. I've spoken to all the congregation. As far as they were concerned, Yarrington was a man devoted to celibacy. It was only these last few months he started being cautious about people coming to his house.
Any progress finding Goddard?
I've asked the London City Council and the coroners and sheriffs of Kent, Surrey and Middlesex to seek out a well-to-do family of that name whose son went for a monk. Nothing.
And I've put the word around so that questions are being asked among all the radical churches and religious groups. He looked at me seriously.
That's a delicate matter. It's fortunate I'm trusted there. But no one so far knows anything of a man of Goddard's description.
Perhaps a handsome young man with dark hair such as Timothy described should also be asked for?
There could be hundreds such, Harsnett said irritably. But I will ask, he added more quietly.
He looked at me.
I'm going to have to change our arrangements today. I'm due to meet with Lord Hartford. Bonner is extending his search for butchers and performers of forbidden plays down to Westminster, but it's not his jurisdiction. We're going to try and stop him.
He looked across the courtyard to the painted tower where Parliament was meeting. Two guards in the red coats of the King's livery standing with pikes at the bottom of the steps.
They're going to pass the act forbidding Bible reading to all but men of gentleman's status, he said quietly. The King has sanctioned it. Our backs are against the wall, he sighed. I'll have to leave you to go to Lockleigh yourself, Sergeant Shardlink, but say you have my authority and he'll find himself arrested if he doesn't cooperate. Let me know what happens. Can you meet me here again in 3 hours?
Yes. It may be worthwhile using the time to visit young Cantrell again, I suggested. Though I don't think he knows anything more.
Yes, anything. Anything that may help us, Master Shardlake.
He gave me a desperate, harried look, then turned to go.
Should we cancel our dinner tonight?
I called after him. He waved a hand.
No, no, we have time for that.
Then he walked quickly away. We returned to Chancery Lane. The streets were crowded now, and I felt nervous and vulnerable as we rode along. My arm hurt too. When we arrived home, Philip Orr was sitting in the kitchen, repairing a broken box.
No sign of anyone around that shouldn't be? I asked.
No, sir, he said seriously. Thank the Lord. Just the usual beggars in Chancery Lane.
Hanging around up to no good like the lawyers.
He gave me a puzzled look. Like many of the radicals, he had a little sense of humour.
I expect you'll be glad when this is over to be able to get back to your normal work, I said.
I realised I didn't know what Orr's usual work was. He smiled sadly.
Spending my days in this kitchen is restful compared to my normal duties, sir. I assist Master Harsnett in collecting the bodies of those who die. I take them to the storage place, and I ensure order in the court, and sometimes go and chase up witnesses who don't wish to appear.
Your master will be missing you, then.
I realised Harsnett had deprived himself in order to ensure our security.
I have an assistant. He will aid him as he can.
We set out again to Smithfield.
Harsnett didn't sound like he's having much luck with his search, Barrick said.
We had reached the country lanes now and relaxed our watchfulness. London and the neighbouring counties are a large area to scour. 60,000 people in London, they say, and more every year.
Aye, and the godly folk will be suspicious of questions, even from arsenic.
That's what this man relies on. The anonymity of this heaving city. He couldn't do what he does in some country parish or even a small town without running a much greater risk of being caught.
Mad and possessed, arsenic called him.
He is not possessed. I decided then to tell Barrack of the conversation I'd had with Guy. As we turned into Holborn and passed the great houses of the rich facing the north side, I told him of DeRay and Stroder. They did what they did for perverted pleasure. Neither God nor the devil came into it. He nodded slowly.
Well, that's true of most of the stronger urges men are subject to. If someone has a desire to beat oars or sodomise boys, the urge seizes them and they have to follow it. Sometimes men who otherwise are quite normal.
He gave me a sidelong look.
Lord Cromwell knew that, and took advantage of it with his spies in the brothels over at Southwark that cater to special tastes.
I know. Obsession, I said quietly. A hidden, all-consuming obsession with violent killing. We passed through a busy throng at Smithfield, for it was market day, and arrived at Charterhouse Square. There were only a couple of beggars sitting on the steps of the old chapel, two older men and an old woman, who looked as though they couldn't move far. The others would be begging at Smithfield, I guessed. I wondered if they supported these old folk, shared the meagre charity they received. There were a couple of other horses at the rail where we tied Suki and Genesis up, and the tavern doors were open. Inside it was busy. A group who looked like Smithfield drovers sitting together. Three ragged weather-beaten men, whom I took to be from the community of beggars, sat at one table quaffing ale. Mrs. Bunce and Lockley were busy, the latter moving among the tables and the former serving behind the bar hatch. The clientele looked up curiously as we entered. Lockley caught sight of us and exchanged a glance with the widow.
"We'd like another word, sir," I said loudly.
"Come into the back."
His tone was low and angry. The clientele looked on with interest as I followed Lockley into a back room, where a moment later Mrs. Bunce joined us. It was a cheerless place, with a scored table and some stools the only furniture. I decided it would do no harm to let Mrs. Bunce remain. She might let something slip.
"What is it?"
Lockley asked us. His manner today was one of angry hostility. He stood with his fists bunched and glared at us with those sharp, deep-set eyes.
"How now, pot man?" Barrack said sharply. "That's no way to talk to a man on business for His Majesty's coroner."
Lockley sighed, shrugged, and sat down at the table. Mrs. Bunce stood beside him.
"What do you want?"
Lockley asked more quietly. "We haven't found Infirmarian Goddard yet."
"Pox on him!"
"Are you sure you know nothing about him that could help us?"
"I told you all I knew last time. Goddard wasn't interested in the lay infirmary. He sneered at me for my ignorance, but let me get on with treating the patients. I had to do everything myself. So far as he was concerned, the patients in the lay infirmary were just a nuisance."
"And those in the monks' infirmary? The ones the young Cantrell dealt with?"
"Goddard had to take better care of them, or he would have had to answer to the community. He kept a close eye on young Cantrell, made him get glasses when it was clear he couldn't see properly."
"I told you before that we're investigating a death. We think it possible that Goddard may have murdered someone."
"How?"
"I may not say. only that it was a violent attack. I would swear that Lockley seemed relieved. He laughed contemptuously.
Goddard would never attack anyone. He was a cold man and a lazy devil, never there when you wanted him. And he had plenty of money.
I know that.
Why should he kill someone?
I nodded slowly.
Yes, I can see you believe that, I said quietly.
Then I looked him in the eye. But I think you're hiding something. Something else to do with Goddard. I advise you to tell me what it is.
Lockley clenched his fists harder on the table. Strong, solid fists, calloused with years of hard work. His face grew red.
Will you leave me alone?
His sudden exclamation startled me, and I saw Barak's hand go to the hilt of his sword.
I know nothing, nothing. Leave me alone. All my life it's been nothing but pester, pester, pester. The patient, Goddard, that wretched barber surgeon, that church of his saying I was damned. And you!
He turned round to Mrs. Bunce and glared at her. Then he put his head in his hands and groaned.
I don't know whether I'm coming or going.
I looked at Barak astonished by this childish outburst. Ethel Bunce's mouth set in a tight line, but I saw tears in her eyes.
What are you hiding, Master Lockley? I asked quietly.
Tell us, and perhaps that will resolve your confusion.
He knows nothing, sir, I'm sure, Mrs. Bunce said. You should have seen the state he was in when I met him, given over to drink, spending the last of the money he had. Francis isn't as strong as he looks.
Lockley jumped up suddenly, the chair banging on the floor behind him.
Get out, both of you, get out!
You could find yourself arrested and questioned in a hard place if you won't answer me, I said quietly.
Then do it, do it! I'm past caring, to hell with you all! I'm going back to my customers!
He started walking to the door. Barak made to step in front of him, but I shook my head. Lockley left, moving quickly for a fat man. Mrs. Bunce hesitated, then looked at us beseechingly.
Francis isn't strong in his mind, sir, she said. What he says is right. All his life he's been pestered by people who think they're better than he is.
So have most people, Barak answered unsympathetically.
But Francis can't take it. It affects him. I've tried to help him, but I think it's ended by him seeing me as another persecutor. Though I'm not. I love him.
She looked at us bleakly.
All right, madam, leave us, I said. When she had gone, Barak said,
we should arrest him.
We don't have the authority, I sighed. We'll tell Harsnett what's happened. My guess is he'll send some men up tonight when the tavern's closed.
Could he be our man? Barak asked.
Most people would be terrified at the prospect of arrest, but he seemed hardly to care. His own woman said he's not quite right in himself.
I shook my head.
Running a tavern is a full-time job. He couldn't possibly have done what the killer has done without Mrs. Bunce knowing. And I can't see him killing Roger or the others. I just can't see it.
You don't know.
I looked at him seriously.
If the killer was Lockley, do you think he'd let us take him alive?
No.
Let Harsnett deal with him,